Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now. You're listening to the best of Taking Aim from our extensive vault. And now here's your hosts, Steve Woodward and David Hensley.
Delighted to be joined today by Robert Bortens, the occasional co-host of this program, CEO of Classical Conversations, the homeschooling empire here in Moore County, also the president of the Moore County Republican Men's Club, and the host of the fabulous podcast Refining Rhetoric, available wherever you find your podcast. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning, everybody.
You bet. Thanks for coming in. Well, you know, Public Enemy Number One kicks off our program every week, and I have to say I've never had an easier decision in picking that dubious honoree, who is former governor of North Carolina, and I'm glad that he's former, but unfortunately he's current candidate for U.S. Senate as a Democrat, running in this year's midterm election for the seat being vacated by spineless Tillis. Tom Tillis.
Yeah.
The Republican opponent, of course, is former RNC chairman Michael Whatley. So it's Whatley versus Cooper. And I think I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that the Whatley campaign has got a treasure trove of campaign ad material, courtesy of a independent journalist who we will hear from later in the program, Stephen Horn, who, I'll use the cliche because it applies, blew the lid off a story that goes all the way back to 2021 when we were all being locked down by then-Governor Cooper amid the hysteria, the manufactured hysteria of the COVID-19 Wuhan pandemic. Cooper got into a little legal tussle with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, which is debatable whether they're actually interested in civil liberties. And he ended up settling a lawsuit which required him, the governor, this man of great power, bowing to the ACLU, releasing all of these very dangerous criminals from our prisons. And he is, because of that, easily public enemy number one this week. So Robert, think about this. It almost seems like this is a Babylon Bee story. Like this couldn't possibly have happened.
Yeah, while he was locking all of us up in North Carolina, he was unlocking the jail cells. And I know you're going to go through those details later in the show, but I mean, he let out over 50 murderers, many of them who have murdered again since he let them go.
Yeah, 53 serving life sentences, 70 convicted of murder.
Wow.
203 convicted of indecent liberties with a child. And more than half of those have gone on to reoffend.
Wow.
Which is a nice way of saying commit more
murders and rapes,
violent crimes against innocent people, and specifically children. Now, the good news about this, if there is any, and it's silver lining, I guess, it's the middle of a campaign in which Cooper has led in all the polls and is presumed to have a rather sizable advantage in fundraising because of all the dark money that will come in from out of the state to support him. But he now has to contend with the fact that in the General Assembly, the Senate leader Berger and House Speaker Hall have formed a legislative subcommittee to investigate this secret reentry settlement list that Cooper was behind, opening the floodgates to these criminals, and then, perhaps as egregiously, doing the bare minimum to inform the public that they were released. In other words, this settlement was supposed to have occurred under the cover of darkness, and we were never supposed to know about it. And then bada bing, bada boom, a couple of independent journalists do a little work, which I know is, you know, journalists and work don't always appear in the same sentence. But in this case, now the lid is blown off this thing. And if I'm the Whatley campaign, I'm churning out an ad a day just on this data alone.
Yeah, I know you're going to talk about it later, but I know Whatley's going to be well-funded. And they're saying they're going to spend combined over $1 billion on this race between all the PACs and fundraising. And so, yeah, be prepared for the most expensive Senate race in U.S. history. And, yeah, someone who is going to put innocent lives at danger by letting hardened criminals go. You know, we saw that poor young lady being murdered in Charlotte. That guy could have been let go by Cooper. I'm not sure those
details.
That is
in fact the case. And the Cooper campaign has tried to weasel around that, saying that Brown was had been early released or something, but that's prior to this mass release. That has been disproven. In our conversation coming up later with independent journalist Stephen Horn, we'll talk about that among other things. But yeah, the literal blood of this Irina Zarutska is on the hands of a candidate for U.S. Senate, Roy Cooper. That's not an overstatement.
If he was a man of integrity, he would drop out of the race today.
Yeah, it seems to me that that is a highly disqualifying stain on his record. But, you know, let's not forget the other things. Let's not forget the businesses that shut down because of his tyrannical behavior during the pandemic. Let's not forget about the learning loss, a subject near and dear to your heart, of kids in our public schools who were, how many months were they out of school? A whole school academic year, and then some in many cases. Some to this day have not recovered in terms of their reading and math proficiency, and just social interaction and mental health, all of these things at the feet of one man, Roy Cooper. And he wants to be a U.S. senator. You know, I have to say that I would be happy to have Tom Tillis stick around rather than have Roy Cooper in the beneath the dome. But
well, Ted Budd was down a similar percentage at this point in the last race, and so it's very. I don't think that Michael Whatley's way too far behind to come back and win by a couple points.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. So, joining us now is Stephen Horn. An independent journalist and the founding editor of the Triangle Trumpet on Substack. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. For those of you who are not familiar with what Stephen has been up to, let's just put it this way. He is a man who's been very much engulfed in his work lately, and for a very good reason. In the past, I don't know, is it past several weeks, we've been seeing these reports via X, also known as Twitter, of a Twitter site called Cooper Released Him, which is dedicated to the examination of the thousands of criminals, literally thousands of criminals, imprisoned criminals released by then Governor Roy Cooper in 2021 during the grip of the COVID pandemic. And many of us have been caught off guard by this story because we're pretty sure that the governor never expected this information to become public. But Stephen, let's take us back to the beginning. The governor, Cooper is the governor. It's 2021. He's shut down the state in all ways imaginable because of the pandemic. Hysteria is rampant everywhere you turn. And along comes the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and they are threatening to sue, I guess, the state of North Carolina or the governor or the North Carolina, prison system, to use a generic term. Threatening to sue unless these prisoners, many serving very extended and serious sentences for very egregious crimes. They're threatening to sue unless all of these people are released from the prisons. And why? To protect them from a mass outbreak of COVID-19. Now, I've been reviewing some of these records, and a lot of these inmates are younger individuals who probably, were they to contract COVID-19, would have had a bad cold for a few days. But that being what it is, why did Cooper acquiesce to the ACLU? Why did he agree to a settlement that involved releasing all of these 4,234 criminals, Stephen?
Well, I guess it depends how much credence you give to his explanation now versus, an analysis of how he has interacted with these left-wing organizations, which are, not always his allies, but definitely in the same ideological alignment. So now his defense is, I fought them in court, but, the judge was ruling against us, so we had no choice but to let them out. But I think if you... If you look how he has aligned himself, who he has been talking to, if you look at his actions during Black Lives Matter, these are very much aligned with the general gist of these organizations, the NAACP, the ACLU, that they want to let criminals out of prison, period, because they see criminals being in prison as racist, because, mm-hmm. Criminals in prison are disproportionately non-white.
Yes.
And so that is the time period that this is going on in 2020 and early 2021 that these decisions are being made. I think if you look at Cooper's statements during that period, you'll see that, tells perhaps a different story than what he would like you to believe now in 2026, where popular opinion has kind of come around to, actually, criminals are bad. They do crime. It's the same criminals doing the crime over and over again. And if you don't prosecute them, if you keep letting them out, they just keep doing more crime. And I think that's part of what this data exposes with the extremely high reoffense rate.
And we shouldn't get too far into this conversation without reminding everyone that then Governor Cooper is now a candidate for the United States Senate as a Democrat in this year's coming midterm elections. He'll be running against Republican Michael Whatley. Cooper has, as far as I know, has never had really a job, but has spent his entire adult life as an elected official. And this could throw a little curveball at him. So he settles with the ACLU to protect these criminals from COVID-19. And I still remember it today like it was yesterday, Cooper saying over and over again, follow the science, follow the science. Well, in this case, the science convinced him that murderers, rapists, child molesters, and other violent criminals needed to be released from our prisons. And here's where we are today. At least 2,412 of these 4,200 plus criminals under this settlement have been convicted of an additional crime or post-release violation since being let out. Gee, what could possibly go wrong? And here's the breakdown from that Stephen Horn has provided us. Of the 53 serving life sentences, is that right? He let out 53 people serving life sentences. That's not a typo.
Yeah, it was previously reported as 51, but looking at the data showed 53.
Well, only one of those went on to reoffend, as they said, the polite word is to commit another crime. 70 convicted of murder, 9 have gone on to commit other crimes since their release. 99 convicted of rape or sexual offense. 45 of these choir boys have gone on to reoffend. And then of the 203 convicted of indecent liberties with a child, if you had more than half on your bingo card, you would be right. 119 reoffenders among that group. So overall, the reoffense rate for these released from prison in 2021 is even higher than the 57% indicated. And why is that? Because data provided by the NC Department of Adult Corrections typically omits crimes where charges were never filed or where charges were dropped, or where the prosecution is in progress and has yet to result in a conviction. So 57%, probably north of 60% of these criminals that Roy Cooper, let out of prison, have gone on to commit other crimes in the community, typically involving innocent citizens going about their everyday lives. So Stephen Horn, thank you again for joining us. You went beyond just the raw data. You have now meticulously looked at each one of these individuals, or you are in the process of doing so, and we're finding out specifically, you know, their names, their mugshots, their original offense that landed them in prison, and then their criminal history, because they all have rap sheets, quite lengthy ones in some cases, and then what they've done since they've been free from prison, thanks to Roy Cooper. Just randomly, I'm looking at Sidney G. Mayo in one of your more recent X posts. Everybody needs to go to Cooper Released Him. Search Cooper Released Him on X, a.k.a. Twitter, and you can read about Sidney G. Mayo, past the Mayo. Criminal history. Before her release, 5 criminal offenses on her record. Released in 2021, offenses post-release, at least 2, and you put 2 plus because as we talked about earlier, we don't know in some cases the status of other prosecutions. So that's one. She is a robbery with a dangerous weapon landed her in the prison. Here's one. Quamterius Griffin. A male about 28 years old, indecent liberty with a child, released by Governor Cooper in 2021. Pre-release offenses, at least 8, folks. Releases offenses post-release, at least 1. And I could go on and on, but Stephen, where are you in this process? You're going through the records of 2,400 really bad guys and gals, and what is your overall takeaway? Is it you're probably not becoming sort of immune to shock at this point, I guess?
Yeah, you know, and that data is coming straight from the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections. It's mostly a case of, you know, taking the list of offenders, you know, they're identified solely by their, you know, OPUS ID, you know, their identification number in that system, that in the release document, all it has is their number. So that this website is mostly just a case of taking that number and looking it up in the data that is published by the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections as a sort of record. And you know, one of the reasons why the numbers there, you know, this is the minimum number of offenses, because if you look at the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections website, you look up a particular offender, you can see that some of these convictions, you know, they sort of merge the convictions together for sentencing. So, you know, you're sentenced for multiple convictions at the same time. Well, the data set I'm working off of, for whatever reason, it doesn't expose all of that data. So it's only the primary conviction. So, you know, for a lot of these, this number is an undercount. You know, they're mm-hmm. actually convicted of more offenses. Sometimes it's multiple, you know, crimes they committed at the same time that are sentenced at once, bundled together. Other times it's crimes committed over some period that, you know, for whatever reason, the judge and or the prosecutors decide to bundle it together and they get sentenced all at once. And it only shows up in as one line in this data that I'm using.
Right.
So it's pretty crazy. And the other factor is that this is sentencing data. So, you know, criminals like DeCarlos Brown Jr., who has been charged with murdering Irina Zarutska, he was arrested a number of times after his release. But in each of those cases, the Mecklenburg district attorney either dropped the charges or never filed the charges, or they're still in progress. And since this is a database of sentencing, you know, DeCarlos Brown doesn't even show up as a reoffender. And that's not even taken into account the fact that about half of crimes go unreported. They're never reported to the police. If you look at the FBI's survey, based on victimization instead of based on, you know, criminals that are arrested. Half of the crimes that are committed in the United States aren't even reported to the police. So the reoffense rate of 56-57%, that is very high, and that is probably significantly lower than the actual percentage of these criminals that have been released that went on to commit a crime. That's the number that has been sentenced in a court or found, you know, through the post-release revocation process, you know, the due process there of throwing them back in prison without an additional conviction if they violated the terms of their release.
We're conversing with Stephen Horn, the founding editor of Triangle Trumpet. Check it out on Substack.com, a North Carolina independent journalist. You mentioned DeCarlos Brown. Now, the Cooper Senate campaign, when the Whatley campaign revealed that Brown was part of this mass release of criminals, the Cooper campaign tried to weasel out of that, as I recall, by saying, oh, no, that was not one of the criminals that were part of the Cooper release. What is the true story there, the actual story?
Well, if you look at the document that his subordinates reported to the court saying these are the offenders we released pursuant to this settlement, DeCarlos Brown is on that list. Yeah. So if they want to go, if he wants to make that argument, he can convince those lawyers to go to the court and say, hey, we were wrong. We told you we released this person pursuant to the agreement, and we actually didn't. Until I see that, I'm a little skeptical of their explanation. Right. Because basically their explanation is, oh, well, it happened before we actually signed the agreement, but we were allowed to count it. Well, why were they allowed to count it? Presumably it's because they knew this agreement was in progress. They knew this settlement was in progress a couple days before it was actually signed and filed with a court. And they were already starting to implement these criteria.
Yeah. So I'm just going to go with then Governor Roy Cooper has blood on his hands in the death of Irina Zarutska on a Charlotte light rail because he was worried that DeCarlos Brown Jr. would be part of a super spreader COVID event. Let's just, you know, that's pretty much the bottom line on that story. And he was out of prison and she's no longer with us because he was let out of prison. After what did he have? 35 priors or 25?
I don't think he was quite that high.
It was a lot.
So to be fair, he probably would have got out of prison in those, you know, 4 or 5 years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So most of these criminals that were released early, you know, except for the criminals serving life sentences who may never have been released, most of these, you know, would have been released at some point between now and then.
Right. And my final question would be this. What reaction have you received, not in terms of media coverage, because I know there's been quite a bit of that, but what are you hearing from, the current governor's office, North Carolina General Assembly, the North Carolina, Attorney General? Is anybody interested in what you've discovered?
Yeah, well, the North Carolina legislature has convened a committee,
correct,
or perhaps a subcommittee to look into these releases specifically. I can't take any credit for that myself, but if they want to use my tool, great. Might help them get some insight to visualize some of these numbers, to sort through some of the criteria. And, you know, any of them are welcome to reach out to me. I've spoken to at least one on the subject. But, you know, I can't claim any credit for that. That was already in progress before the release of this site. In terms of the response from the public, obviously, I'm seeing a lot of people who are, you know, shocked and incensed. And then on the other hand, you see people who are just like, well, Trump did this, or well, Whatley did this. It's like, okay, well, whatever. Like that doesn't really change what Cooper did when Cooper was governor. You know, Trump was never governor of North Carolina. Whatley has never been governor of North Carolina. So this is about exposing this particular data from the government. It's not data I'm coming up with. This is data from the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections. Mm-hmm. And if your only response is to try to deflect, I think that says something about what this data is actually showing.
I agree with you completely. And let's keep something else in mind as well. just because one of these convicted criminals, murderers, rapists, child molesters, since the release to this moment in time, has not committed a crime, doesn't mean they won't. Doesn't mean they're not still out there lurking and imposing a threat to communities across North Carolina. And that's also bears repeating as we go forward with this story. Stephen Horn, I thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for your work, and we hope to speak again with you in the future.
Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
The best of Taking Aim continues now with your hosts, Steve Woodward and David Hensley.
This country still delivers on the promise of unlimited potential for every human being who comes here legally.
Yeah, and it does it better than anyone else, and it does it because of our conservative values, despite the fact that it's been under attack. I mean, I remember when the European Union was formed, and all my leftist friends were like, this is so exciting, the EU, because of their progressive ideas, are just going to beat the United States and show that our ideas are better than everyone else's. Now, it's better to be poor in Mississippi, our poorest state, than to be middle class in Europe. That's how bad the EU has destroyed their economy. That our poorest, you know, GDP state is now richer than their richest countries. There's two countries out of, you know, the entire EU that are doing well, and they're basically ones that have continually elected center right you know, politicians to lead their government and have rejected most of what the EU is doing. I'm sure NBC was not super happy that this is what his answer was. Things like work hard, learn English, but you know, my grandparents on my father's side immigrated here. My wife's grandparents on her mother's side immigrated here during World War One, and that was the first thing they did was, or World War Two, was learn English, and work hard to integrate themselves into our society. And so when we have intelligent immigration system and things like that, Trump's trying to do, bring in intelligent people into our country, it works well. But when we have criminals pouring through our southern border like the Democrats want, because they know that they can bribe them to vote for them, it doesn't work so well for our country. And so tipping my hat to this wonderful jockey, and yeah, dream big.
And you've just teed up a great immigration story. Play clip 4.
I want to tell you a story of a young woman in particular that you probably have never heard of. Her name is Marianne. She was born on the remote island of Lewis in Scotland. This is a place of hard, scrapping life, high winds. It was 1930. She was 18 years old, and she got on a boat to come to Ellis Island in 1930 on May 2nd. Today is the anniversary. She arrived here 11 days later. She was bound for Ellis Island and the United States of America. I want to show you a picture. It's a painting that I did, and then I ran out of time and talent, and so I asked a good friend of mine to help me, Mike Malm, who is an amazing portrait artist. This is how I envision her coming into the United States. She came here, she wasn't chasing fame, she wasn't chasing riches or power. She came just for the opportunity. Her sister was already here and found a job. And so she decided to come. She stood in this room and wrote her name down, Mary Ann McLeod. And next to it What's your job? Domestic. She and her sister were maids. She came to America knowing that she would serve and clean the houses and the toilets of the wealthy families here in New York, and she roomed with her sister together. And they lived and worked hard through the worst days of the Depression, and she persevered. She's here for 6 years, and she meets a man. She marries him. His name is Fred. He was the son of German immigrants. In 1942, she became a citizen, and Mary and Fred would end up having 5 children, 2 daughters and 3 sons. And one of those sons, they named him Donald. Her son would become a real estate tycoon. Her son would change that skyline. That's the skyline that she saw. Look out that window and look at that skyline. Her son, a woman who came here as a maid, the lowest of jobs, would raise a son who would become a real estate mogul and the 45th and 47th president of the United States of America.
I am Steve Woodward, and I'm joined by a very special guest co-host this morning, Kent Mizegades. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be back.
There is a book in circulation, which I imagine by now is on all of the bestseller lists. It has a title that will especially attract attention here in Moore County. It is entitled The Fort Bragg Cartel, and it is authored by a young independent journalist named Seth Harp, who is a contributing editor to, among other publications, Rolling Stone. Seth is a Texan who was deployed to Iraq in the early days of that war when he was still a teenager and attending the University of Texas in Austin. And he came back from a 528-day deployment, kind of ticked off at the U.S. military and very sure that we were in Iraq for a lot of wrong reasons. And he decided to make it his life's work to become an independent journalist, exploring the true stories inside the U.S. military. And he has uncovered a big one here with his book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, which basically lays out a culture of drug trafficking, violence. He has chronicled a number of murders that have taken place on the base that have never really been solved and whose perpetrators have never been charged. It is a book that is truly revealing, and he goes into deep detail about the culture of drug abuse and the fact that drug testing on base, on Fort Bragg, is essentially a joke. It is totally ineffective. Everybody gets around it. And the culture of drug abuse is rampant, according to his reporting. He made reference to Mr. Dumas, who is a deceased soldier, a man who knew way too much, and his case is discussed at length in this book as well. I think it's a book that, whether you have ties to the military in Fort Bragg or not, is probably worth reading, because it certainly is alarming. And the good news is, you know, under the Trump administration and his team, I think Pete Hegseth as defense secretary, you know, I think recruiting is up. I think the culture of the military is going to be changing. But boy, there's a lot to unwind there and a lot to undo.
Yeah, well, and it all starts with transparency. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the problems with drugs being brought over by our military from Vietnam and then, of course, sold on the black market. It's been a while, but it was done then, too. There's a couple of bad apples, you know, always out there. But there's sweeping these things under the rug only makes it worse. So I think, wow, hats off to Seth Harp. It's pretty gutsy for him to come out and do this, especially because he's talking about his own brothers in there. And, you know, you got to do it. It reminds me of something, Steve. Gosh, 10 or 15 years ago, there was an explosion in South Raleigh at a recycling facility, and they come to find out that these were duds. These were artillery shells that had been fired on the range at Fort Bragg, and they didn't explode. And there were some people from Sanford that were getting in across the fence, and they were going in and digging these things out and then hauling them up and selling them. Well, it turns out they have, of course, compacting machines, and they were compacting the metal, and a couple of these things went off and blew the place up. So they had to shut the whole area down and go through everything. And eventually they apprehended the couple of guys doing this. So, you know, it's out there, and, you know, the best way to get to the bottom of this is to first tell the truth and deal with it. Very tragic, though, about these. But I recall when these two fellows went missing and never did hear how it was resolved. Now we know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, very sad for their families too.
And that's just one, you know, that's just one case of many in his book, the Fort Bragg Cartel.
Well, the drugs too. Case in point, also, I had a friend. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Very tragic end to his life. And he related to me how drugs were handed out just like M&Ms to them, and they weren't required to refuse them. So it was easy for people to get hooked on them while being deployed and other things where they had mental issues or pain, just take another pill. So it was easy to get hooked on them. So it's not too surprising that stuff would also be then taken outside the base and sold.
So as we know, all of us who've lived here for a period of time, there is an inextricable link between this community and the military and foreign affairs. And along the same lines of some of the intrigue that is described in the book that we just heard about, Kent, you've got some insights into an operation up in Cameron that I would dare say very few people know anything about, but I think we should talk about it this morning. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what's going on up Highway 1 in Cameron?
Yeah, thank you. So this news came to me from a friend, a retired fellow up in Kerry, who every time he sees a news item for the Sandhills, he sends it to me. And this one surprised me because we hadn't seen it. And so the headline here, and I'm reading actually from the Moore County News. If you want to know about every car wreck and arrest in Moore County, you look in the Sandhills Sentinel or the Moore County News. You don't look in the Pilot. But at any rate, this was an article from July 27th of this year by Patrick Priest of the Moore County News. And the title is $23.9 million Moore County estate could break the North Carolina real estate record. So this describes actually a brand new compound. Yeah, there's no other better word for it. 530-acre property is called the C-Bar 3 Farm. It includes three separate homes, two private lakes, a variety of amenities built with privacy and sustainability. That's kind of a laugh in mind. It includes a 9,700 square foot modern style home accompanied by a guest house, a hunting lodge, a recreational feature such as a pool spa, outdoor kitchen, wellness building, including a gym, sauna, yoga studios, miles of ATV trails, shooting ranges, on and on and on, over 500 acres. And I thought, and it's located just off Highway 2427 between Carthage and Camera. But it's only been completed this year. Hmm. So, you know, the first thing I ask is, well, why didn't the Pilot report on this? They're literally obsessed with the lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Right.
And I thought, I smell a rat. What's going on here? So I dug up a little bit. It wasn't hard to find. There's actually quite a few articles on the owner. You can look up the property records on it and find who actually owns it. So there's another article out here from 2022 in Fortune magazine, but is actually by the AP, Alan Suderman, October 27, 2022. And it describes the owner, a fellow by the name of Kevin Chalker, ex-CIA officer, who used the skills that he acquired in the CIA as an analyst, he's called, basically to help the Qataris spy on their rivals, starting with their application to have Qatar become a venue for the 2022 Soccer World Cup. And if you know anything about these things or Olympics, there's a lot of politics involved.
Oh.
Because there's a lot of money involved, right?
Exactly. And you know, Qatar was like one of the worst possible places to put the World Cup, given the climate.
The climate.
I mean, they did pull it off, but...
Yeah, in fact, in this article, they show the what they call the Qatar Education Stadium, one of the 2022 World Cup stadiums. And the description is, it's an open, cooled stadium with a 45,000 seat capacity. Can you imagine that? Open and cooled.
And I'm sure it's now like a white elephant, right? Just sitting,
sitting
in the desert.
There. Could be. Yeah. Could very well be. Well, at any rate, Kevin's activities were apparently fairly effective. He is actually, if you read up a little bit more on him, he has multiple patents related to techniques he developed, hacking people's phones and internet, which I guess is something the CIA does, I suppose. And he's continued to do that as a private businessman. He has his own consulting business. And it really came to attention here by the FBI and others when he started doing fairly overt things for the Qataris, which, depending on who you ask, is friend or foe. I mean, we do know, of course, we have a major military facility there that's important to us in the Middle East. But they also came in the news because they were harboring and protecting the leader of Hamas.
And any number of other of his sidekicks, all living in high-rise penthouses, driving around in Bentleys.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, they're living the life down in Qatar while, you know, the Hamas wreaks havoc on Palestine and
Palestine.
Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at any rate, his company, the GRA, Global Risk Advisor, worked together with Qatari officials and top CIA leaders, helping to promote, not only promote Qatar as a venue, but also to smack down any opponents to that, which also included an American, a U.S. congressman, who really wasn't too happy about an American working on behalf of the Qatari. They've got offices in New York, Washington, London, and Doha. There's even a YouTube video that shows him with his staff sitting at the very top floor of the new World Trade Center talking about what a great place it is to have an office. So it looks like he's done fairly well for himself.
Well, the House certainly suggests that, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it really does. And he had already pitched this idea of having a private version of the farm. So the farm, if you watch any spy movies, the farm is where the CIA teaches people to do whatever stuff they do. And so his whole idea was to create basically a private version of the CIA farm, and then he could bring his clients in and teach them the same methods. And in fact, he actually did this, not here at the Cameron facility, but, and again, reading from this article, he says, one member of the Qatari royal family received a perfect score of 100 in a technical surveillance countermeasures course, despite missing much of the instruction and not showing a genuine desire to learn the material. Well, you know, if you pay enough money, I guess you get it. He's known for he prizes secrecy, and he uses various code names. He calls himself Hercules, which is kind of funny. And, you know, more and more you read this, and it looks like a bad James Bond movie, actually. But for what it's worth, he's earned a pile of money, at least $200 million from the Qatari, doing various things such as opposing Florida Republican Representative Mario Diaz-Balart, who wanted to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. So Mr. Chalker's company proposed Project Endgame. Don't you love these names? And this was to oppose Qatari's enemies in, you know, the various things that's important to those nice folks in Qatar. And I thought this was kind of interesting that all this is happening basically under our nose and nobody's talking about it, especially not the great media giant here, the pilot. And now I understand why. I mean, the sort of things that he's doing, they might, I don't know if they'd approve it, but they probably wouldn't disapprove of it. For what it's worth, if anyone's, you know, in the market for a, you know, a new weekend house, he's got one. All you need is $24 million. Maybe they've sold it. I haven't checked recently. Maybe it's still there. But a friend of mine actually lives right next to it. And I asked him, says, what do you know about this guy? And he says, well, nobody knows anything. Says, we never really see him. Another friend of mine actually did some work there. And he said he actually met this fellow. And he says, oh, he's really arrogant. But, you know, I guess it comes with the job. They're not the only one. I mean, there are other CIA-related things. We know us aviators. There's an outfit called Aero Contractors that has its own special area at the Johnston County Airport. They're essentially what's left of Air America from the Vietnam era. They do all kinds of special operations for the CIA. I mean, they're great pilots and mechanics, and they keep things very quiet. And as far as I know, they don't have a 530-acre compound anywhere. They just do their thing.
I just wonder if the home, I mean, there's all, it only takes one buyer, as they say in the real estate business, but I just wonder if that is a, if that's going to get that price and if it's going to sell. Because if you just do a quick perusal of record home sales in Moore County, they're all like $3 and $4 million. That's considered the
high end, right?
I mean, the homes, some of the most beautiful homes inside the gates of like number 7 and number 9 and over in Forest Creek and over at CCNC, even the highest end on the scale with those homes, you're talking about $3, $4, $5 million at the most. So call it $24 million.
$24 million.
Of course, you're getting a ton of land, 500 plus acres.
It could. I mean, I suppose maybe he was trying to set it up as another CIA farm and hoping the CIA might buy it. Maybe the Qataris will buy it. I mean, who knows? If we see camels showing up out there, we'll know, right?
I mean, you can go out to Young's Road in Horse Country in Southern Pines and pick up 20 or 30 acres for a couple of million dollars with a house and a barn. But it's not $24 million.
It's not $24
million. No.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see. At any rate, I guess if you're making that kind of money, you can afford to maybe come down on the price a little bit. We'll see.
Right. Exactly right. Well, that and speaking of prices and quality of life and living here in North Carolina, so let's talk about a slightly broader but not and actually much more relevant topic to our future here in North Carolina and in this country. And you have been looking into why North Carolina is uniquely predestined to experience in coming years an energy crisis. Now, that's going to get some heads and spinning, perhaps, exploding, I don't know. Why are we looking at such a dire forecast?
Well, it all has to do with the energy policy and the shifts. And I go back to, again, 1975. I came here at the recommendation of, at the time, a neighbor of ours in northern Alabama who ran the Browns Ferry nuclear power plant. For many, many years, it was the world's largest nuclear power plant. Four large units on the Tennessee River, humming away for the last 50 years, safe, inexpensive power. That's why there's so much industry along the Tennessee River. In fact, that's how we ended up there. My father built a factory for GE Appliances back in the early 70s. Back in 75, North Carolina State University was known to have one of the finest nuclear engineering programs in the world. They had the very first teaching reactor on campus. They had the very first advanced degrees in nuclear engineering. And the faculty was largely built up from people that had been involved in the Manhattan Project and the early application of that to nuclear power. So, I mean, they really were going in a great direction. You look at it today, and now we're second, I think, only to California in the use of expensive intermittent solar power. So, you know, things have really changed. Back in the 70s, there were already plans for Sheeran Harris nuclear plant. It wasn't completed. I think they were starting to clear the land for Jordan Lake. That reactor back then was originally slated to have four units, much like Browns Ferry. Well, they never got more than one. Don't know why exactly. I was gone by that time. But the state was very supportive of nuclear power. We don't have much fossil fuel, although, ironically, the only major reserve of coal and natural gas is right under our feet. in fact, in northern Moore County, something called the Cumnock Formation. And the studies I've read say that today it would be profitable at least to extract the natural gas out of there. And that's, in my opinion, the real future of power in this country. So a lot of things have changed in this state. And, you know, I lived at a time in Germany when the Greens were coming to power. This all happened in the early 1980s.
That would be the green energy.
The alternative energy, the new
lobby.
Yeah, this was the anti-nuclear. And how that came about, of course, yeah, side note to that. So my plans for a career in nuclear industry were dashed when Jimmy Carter was elected. And one of the ways they got him into power, because he had all kinds of people, basically, he was a puppet, more or less, of all kinds of Fruit Loop groups. One of the ways that they got him in there was this anti-nuclear stance. And I suspect they had already learned that from the Europeans, because what happened was when the communist regimes like the Soviet Union were starting to crumble, people saw that. So you had a lot of socialists that needed another cause. They needed another way to realize their fascist dreams of controlling everything. Well, the whole environmental movement actually provided that outlet to them. In fact, if you read about, there's some things written by the original founder of Greenpeace, who left Greenpeace because of the extremists. He said that when the Soviet Union collapsed, they had all these people show up with Che Guevara t-shirts, and they swapped them out for whale t-shirts. And that's essentially what was happening in Germany in the early 1980s, people looking for a cause. These were generally affluent people, well-educated, but, you know, they had meaningless jobs somewhere. So they decided they were going to do that. Oddly enough, their very first target of their protest was expansion of the Frankfurt Airport. And they'd chained themselves to the fence. They didn't want the additional runway added. But that kind of belly flop, but at least they got started. And that was the Green Party, which now is all over the place. Then they eventually segued into nuclear power, and that became, and they eventually managed to convince the German government to scrap their very advanced nuclear power program, which at that time included probably the world's most advanced breeder reactor. That's a way of dealing with waste and turning it back into fuel. Well, they sold it all off, and of course now they're at the point where they've just about closed all the nuclear power plants. They adopted a stance of what they called green, primarily through solar and wind energy, and because of that, they have the highest electricity costs in probably in the whole world right now. Just absolutely devastating on the people and devastating on industry. It's just destroying the industry. They're all moving here and other places where they have low-cost, stable electricity. And I've watched this because we're over there every year. I worked there for 9 years in two different segments. I've seen it all happen, all the shenanigans. And they're just running over a cliff. It's really doubtful whether they'll survive, frankly. This whole movement came to the U.S. originally in California, of course.
Of course.
Of course. If you recall their governor, Grayout Davis, they had a policy of not building any more fossil or nuclear power plants, but buying it from other states that used coal. And they could just jack up the price or turn the screws on them anytime, just like Putin did to you, has been doing to Europe. And that, of course, has resulted in grayouts. That is, when the demand exceeds the capacity, they have to shut them off somewhere, right? And that's what this whole smart thermostat thing is about. Don't do that. I mean, the utilities would like to be able to control your thermostat if they could.
That got Gray Davis, who was a Republican, recalled, didn't it?
He got recalled.
He was booted. Yeah.
That's right. Because they were having, you know, grayouts. Well, it's an inconvenience, right, at home if you don't have your air conditioning on. It's a big deal if you're running an industry that's absolutely dependent upon power, right, or someone medical requirements. So that stuff started out there. And of course, eventually they were looking for some other sucker state, and they found North Carolina.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters doing what we do best, taking aim.